You're listening to 42 Macros Pro to Pro Live, hosted by Darius Dale.
Howdy, Team 42. It's your skipper here, Darius Dale, to present another fantastic episode of Pro to Pro Live. I'm joined with our friend, the one and only Brent Kachuba from Spot Gam. How you doing, Brent?
I'm doing really well. It's been a while since I talked to you, so I'm always excited for more Darius in my life.
I appreciate it. Likewise, man. I was going to say, last time we were on the program, I want to say you had a gnarly beard. you're looking about 10 years younger, my friend. What's the story behind that?
Well, I was telling you before, my daughter refuses. She's five. She won't give me a kiss if I have a beard. So beard is gone. And, you know, you're a new dad, so you understand what that's like.
100%.
When your kids ask, you have a son, I have daughters. Daughters, I think, get a different feedback me a little bit. Like,
oh, 100%.
I jump.
100%. Absolutely. You ask how high in midair.
That's right.
So happy for you and your family, man. And appreciate you, man. I've learned a lot from you over the years, man. You are one of the world's best at helping investors understand and profit from what's going on in the bond market. And also relating that back to how it's likely to impact broader asset markets. So kudos to you for what you built at Spot Gamma. I'll start these conversations with kind of where we always try to aim to start, kind of from a 30,000 foot view. You know, what's your general sense of the world, both from a macro standpoint, but also more specifically, like where you think we are kind of in the vol cycle, how, you know, where, you know, what you generally expect from asset markets over a short to medium term time horizon?
Yeah, it's you and I would also just talk. You said you feel like things are more frenetic now. And, you know, I think that's kind of like a life statement, right? Like everyone's attention span is very short. And so that's one interesting thing. But as in terms of my work, I think that there's a tremendous amount of leverage in the system. And I'm not talking about money supply and the things that you focus on. I'm talking about trading flows. You look at massive options positions in the short dated, kind of shortest dated tenor, so zero DTEs that everyone has been talking about. You get leveraged ETFs. You look at kind of the growth of volumes, options overall, which I think is just kind of leverage in the system and in the flows. And I think that creates a lot of this frenetic trading nature that we're seeing. And, you know, it makes it a little bit tricky because there's so much kind of whipsawing in the short term that I think you either have to trade very short term or you, like you had mentioned, you were sort of zooming out. You have a longer term take on things. It's kind of like, well, we could ignore each of these like interim caps, right, in the waves that we're surfing here because overall the boat is going in this direction. So just let it go and don't worry about each individual little wave. And so, you know, I think that these short-term, you know, the short-term leverage in the system causes short-term price dislocations, which I think is interesting for people in your seat that have longer-term views.
No, look, I'd spot on. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, we've increasingly, you know, going back to January of 2023 when we made the pivot to completely lean into our systematic risk management processes, which are more, you know, medium-term trend-oriented in nature. You know, I basically said, look, I don't have as much bandwidth and more importantly, I would argue, I don't have as much sophistication to do short to medium term as well as I thought I did. And so, you know, I kind of completely reorganized our, you know, risk management process to kind of the medium to long term, you know, where are we going to be, you know, over the next, you know, 2 to 3 quarters, you know, 2 to 4 quarters. That's kind of our sweet spot, both from a fundamental forecasting standpoint, but also in terms of, you know, how risk management systems tend to stand on the right side of market risk. So, you know, it's the kind of, you know, 0 days to, you know, 1 to 2 quarters where I would argue your work is incredibly valuable for investors in terms of, you know, creating real good high probability scenarios for them to act on. And, you know, I'd be interested to kind of hear what your, you know, your latest thoughts are on that in that regard.
Yeah, thanks for that. So I started doing this in January of 2020, and we used to really focus on the third Friday.
This being Spot Gamma, by the way. You're
Spot Gamma. Sorry. I'm sad to say, but I don't want to age myself, but I have over 20 years of institutional experience. I worked at several different banks, an options market maker, and a family office. So 20 years of experience, but I started Spot Gamma officially in January of 2020. And we used to talk about the options flows tied to the monthly expirations, right? And there was this cycle, and you could really kind of set your watch to the flows around the cycle and kind of forecast the impact of that. And you kind of fast forward to now, zero DT options. A lot of people talked about, you probably said, Brendan, I'm tired of hearing this, but the fact is that 55% of SPX index options are zero DTE now. And that's billions of dollars of hedging flows day in and day out related to these positions. And these positions will be there today and then they will be gone tomorrow. For example, there's this big iron condor trade we talk about all the time. And if you watch where those legs are, the market will move or respond to those strikes. And that happens on a daily basis, right? So the cycle of flows that I watch has become, again, much shorter term in nature. And then I mentioned the leverage before. And what I think the value of that now for people who have a longer term view is you get these price dislocations now that can be extreme. And it's not every day, but once a month at least, if not more often, you see some type of extreme price dislocation either in the market itself or in a major single stock. I'll give you an example. 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, was the NVIDIA DeepSeek news, right? NVIDIA had, as I'm sure you talked about, the biggest one-day market cap loss ever. I think that was the 27th, is that right?
Yeah.
Over $500 billion of market cap loss. Stock was down 16% in a day, right? And, you know, if you look at that actual DeepSeek headline, the news was kind of out before that already. Like, it wasn't necessarily anything new. And you kind of fast forward and it's like, well, NVIDIA now stock has almost kind of rebounded from that sort of level. So like, what was that? And the thing that I think is interesting is if you look at NVIDIA, it is the number one largest option single stock that there is. There's more open interest in that stock than any other single stock. Second only to the SPX index in terms of notional values trading. Wow. Second thing is there are billions upon billions of dollars of levered ETFs in NVIDIA, like the NVIDIA 2X long ETF, for example. So when NVIDIA goes down 5%, not only do you have these options flows, which are leveraged, right, because of the hedging nature, but then you have these ETFs, which are hedged in a variety of different ways. But you see these headlines come out nowadays that say, hey, you know, such and such ETF can't get any more swap lines from their banks because the assets have grown too big, right? And the assets flood into these things and flood out. So when you get a move, I'm just kind of saying this as an anecdote, right? Maybe NVIDIA should have only been down 3% on that news, but it ends up down 10% because of this leverage. And then people see that 10% move and they go, oh my gosh, this DeepSeek news must be really important because NVIDIA stock is down 10%, when in fact, it's just the leverage, right? That is driving the price dislocation. So when I look at a lot of these names that are moving a lot, you can see it's oftentimes interesting to compare the underlying volatilities on these things and see, hey, vol's not really moving in sync, or vol is kind of jumping more than we expect. But we know that there's these giant flows that are exacerbating these price moves. So the kind of soapbox I've been standing on lately is, you've probably heard the axiom, you know, the news doesn't matter, it's the reaction to the news that matters, right? Well, now it's almost kind of like the opposite. It's like, the reaction to the news oftentimes is so overbaked and overdone that because of this leverage that people could then go, the DeepSeek news, oh my gosh, like the United States economy, like put a fork in it, like let's all go, you know, start paying yuan for stuff now because China's got us by the, you know what. So, and it turns out like you fast forward a couple weeks, it's like, no, that's not really true, right? So, you know, that's the kind of things that happen. And so that's just NVIDIA. But you can look at the same thing in terms of, you know, you look at like Palantir's had this incredible move up and the vol gets really stretched to the upside. Tesla's been another one where after the election, the amount of call options in that stock went bananas, right? And vol spikes and the name doubles. And I think people go, well, you know, Tesla must be firing on all cylinders, excuse the pun. And they're not. It's just like there's this extra options leverage that's in the system. So for people, I think, that have that longer term view, knowing that these leveraged positions can create these significant price dislocations, maybe you want to be a buyer of the dip in there, or maybe you just want to think twice about selling because the paradigm really didn't change because it's just this leverage that is exacerbating movement, right? It's like a margin call, right? If someone's getting a margin call and they're puking, you're generally happy to be on their side of that stock, right? Because you know they're forced out of it and they're causing that short-term price dislocation. It's not that you don't know that something's coming your way. Do you know what I mean?
No, look, you're basically creating you're making the case for a more bifurcated market across time horizons, right? Like I think, you know, the market's always been bifurcated across time horizons. You have different types of investors that focus on different asset classes that inherently have different catalysts that are, generally speaking, you know, have signal over various time horizons. So that's kind of certainly an institutional finance speak that's always been the case. But what I think is happening is, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I essentially heard you say is that because we have a lot more inherent leverage in the system that is concentrated shorter duration, mm-hmm. we have a higher level of realized volatility, especially in response to news, than we used to have. And what that ultimately means is we probably have more short-term price dislocations relative to underlying fundamentals, medium to longer term fundamentals. And so it probably makes it more lucrative for investors to concentrate themselves in a time horizon buckets. You know, if you're a short to medium term person who can take advantage of these types of price dislocations and provide liquidity to the market, you know, in these moments, you can make a lot of money. At the same time, you can provide liquidity to the market in these moments and have a fundamental view that you're either building or you know, reducing a position associated with that. So to me, I think it just makes the game a little bit more exciting, mm-hmm. more fun. There's more opportunity from the perspective of investors, you know, to the extent that they are aware of these dynamics.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you put it so well, as you always do. I basically equate this all to jump risk. So the idea is that we're stable right now, fleetingly stable, but in a minute, as we've seen these Trump headlines, right, we'll be down 3 to 5%, you know, like that in the S&P or the Qs because Trump tweeted about this or DeepSeek came out about that. And there's no sort of like auto correlation to that move. Like it doesn't actually, that realized vol, that jump. This is the other interesting part of this equation or dynamic is that that jump doesn't seem to translate to longer term volatility, right? So normally, if you saw the S&P, like we've had three separate instances of this roughly in the last 2 weeks, S&P's gone from 6,100 to 6,000, right, in the matter of like an hour. Like we'll just, like it's a liquidity hole. Like we just drop, right? There's no bid. It's just down we go. So we'll have a 2% drop, right? 1 to 2% drop. And realized vol, when you look at a month, doesn't budge, right? There's no reaction to that at all. Normally, what you would expect is when we have a volatility kind of spasm like that, you would see longer dated vols lift. You would see positions shift a little bit. You would think that there would be a little bit of stickiness to that jump. But it just doesn't exist right now, right? It's just not there. To this point, you know, CPI this morning, S&P was down, futures are down 1%. S&P's rallied all the way back. And you look at 1 month vols out 2-3 months and they haven't budged from like 13%, right? So there's no reaction to that at all. And I think some of that is you have these short dated positions that are either piling on or bringing mean reversion, whatever it is, they're impacting the market, but there's like this stable point 1 month out that's not really shifting. And the only time you really seem to see that stable point shift is when there's like an obvious unknown that comes in, right? Think of like the Silicon Valley bank crisis, for example. It's like, we all know the banks are risk, you know, having some risk here, banks are failing, more banks might fail. We don't know which ones and we don't know when it is. I can't hedge that with a zero DTE or 1 week option. I got to buy, you know, like a 3 month put, for example, to hedge myself in that scenario. So it's those like obvious long-term threats that seem to lift fall and present some risk to the system. But, you know, without that, people seem to be able to hedge out kind of idiosyncratic risk, like a, you know, Fed statement or CPI with these short dated options. You get a little bit jumpiness in the short dated options, but things ultimately just sort of seem to mean revert in the long term vols and options prices remain pretty stable.
Brian, I'm so grateful that you described the market conditions that I've been observing this way, because it speaks volumes to a structural change we made in one of our core signals. We decided to improve one of our core models that allows us to now cast a market regime, and it allows our discretionary risk management overlay to, you know, send out more stable signals with respect to its proper trade recommendations across the 70 factors that it tracks. And the genesis for making that improvement was there's a lot more short-term realized volatility, but the trend isn't changing. Mm-hmm. And so what I don't want is to have a systematic process that generates a high frequency of false alarms because the trend isn't changing. Mm-hmm. And so I essentially may slow the whole entire process down so that it can have a little bit more elasticity in the shorter term with respect to some of these high realized volatility moments in the market that don't ultimately, to your point, have a significant influence over the medium term trend. And so as a function of that, our models are even better than they used to be at you know, not generating false alarms and sending out more stable, more accurate signals. And so I'm so great. I mean, just completely random that, you know, you were on the calendar. We scheduled this 3 months ago prior to even me thinking about making that improvement. But it just so happens that you're, you know, one of the world's experts at this are seeing a lot of the sort of anecdotal evidence. You're confirming a lot of the anecdotal insights that I was picking up on. So appreciate you for hammering that point home.
Yeah, of course. I'm glad I could do it. And another thing I just wanted to bring up, I wanted to, this was a topic that came in over the summer. And if you remember over the summer, we had all this anomalous activity in the market. We had, we measure, or there's a CBOE index called correlation, C-O-R-1-M is the ticker, you can look it up. And that's equity index correlation. So they compare the options prices in the top S&P 500 names, so Google, Apple, Tesla, et cetera, versus the prices of the SPX index options themselves, right? So single stock options versus index options. And correlation as a metric hit the lowest level it's hit since 2017. 2017 is significant because that was lowest realized volatility we ever saw in the market, right? 1 month realized vol, which is kind of the standard metric in the option space. 1 month realized SPX vol hit 3.5%. That was the lowest ever. It was the most boring market. I don't, you know, I'm sure you traded back then.
Never made more money. 2017 and 2021, man.
It was so boring. And then, you know, so correlation went below that level, and Trump was in office back then, which is also interesting, right? And then in 2018, obviously, we have the unwind of all of a lot of that in Volmageddon in January of 2018. So we broke that low in August. And this is what drives this is people rushing into mainly NVIDIA options, but the semi-stock, AI is the savior, and that was causing all this bizarre price behavior, right? So we had the longest stretch of time in, I think, 20 years without a 2% move up or down in the S&P, you know, into August and all that. So kind of like July, you see, I think we measured 10 things we hadn't seen in the last 20 years, like major, you know, indicators, right? And then what happens? Like July, it all unwinds, it all breaks, and then we have August 5th, we see VIX print or calculate over 60, right? There's some argument in the options nerds will argue that a little bit, but vol went crazy, and then people go, it's the yen carry trade that broke this whole thing. Not at all, right? Not, I mean, that was the whipped cream on top. That's the headline or the narrative that people assigned to it. It is all this leverage that gets built up and then it unwinds and then, you know, it unwinds in a second. It's a famous axiom, you know, kind of like stairs up, elevator down, or escalator up, elevator down, right? So the thing, my long-winded story here is that the thing we were talking about a lot, which made me think about this, was what is the tradable float now of a lot of these top stocks? Because indexing as a market flow, I guess, is increasing, or as positioning in indexing is increasing. The number of ETFs is increasing. The number of levered ETFs is increasing. You know, so you have buybacks, which are huge, right? There's all of these flows or mechanisms, I would say, that almost reduce the tradable float of a lot of these stocks. You know, and I've been trying to sort of crack a lot of this data, is like five figures plus to buy this underlying data to try to actually figure this out. Yeah. But you know, the thesis is here that there's just less underlying liquidity because there's just less tradable float that's available for, like, say, an NVIDIA or a Tesla. Even though it's this mega cap stock, you can have the world's number three market cap stock drop 16% in a day. Kind of speaks to that, right? And so the other point is that, you know, you have this lower tradable float as shares are essentially kind of like put on ice, right? Because they're in this ETF or they've been bought back by Apple or whatever they may be. And so, you know, I think that this dynamic is just one that is going to be persistent and maybe even increasing as the leverage increases and possibly that tradable float decreases. So maybe that works more for your models going forward. Yeah.
No, look, I appreciate you bringing that up. A couple things on the NVIDIA side. Can you ever think of a moment in your career where, like, the world's biggest stock, both in nominal terms but also in terms of ownership, had like a 10%+ decline, and like it wasn't the start of a new bear market or something like
that? No, the S&P, you know, the S&P didn't budge. I mean, S&P was down, sorry. But the Dow, which actually has a very small component of NVIDIA, was like up on the day or flat, right? Yeah. So, you know, this speaks to the correlation to your point and to the liquidity. I mean, that was literally the largest market cap loss ever, as you well know. And so it literally has never happened before. Yeah. And it's just, it's wild, right? You can't imagine a scenario where you go, look, we're going to take the it's in a, for a lot of reasons, it's the world's number one stock, right? I mean, so much is tied to what that stock does, even if it's number two market cap. You know, that AI chip space is so important. And so to have that drop and you go, hey, S&P is going to not react to this really at all, is a shocking kind of statement, right?
100%. And I feel like the, you know, the macro, typical quote unquote macro gurus that I like to make fun of on Twitter, they would go, you know, this is Minsky leverage building up in the system. This is going to end spectacularly. And what I think separates institutional macro people from people who are selling subscriptions, which, you know, I'm also selling subscriptions, but clearly we have a large institutional client base. What separates those people is understanding, okay, it has not ended yet. So let's keep making money until it ends and have robust, you know, Bayesian inference processes to spot when when it's time to go.
Yeah.
Right. That's the difference between what we do at 42 Macro and what a lot of folks are doing, which is, hey, if we're in a bull market, we need to be making money. We need to be maximizing upside capture.
Yeah. And kind of to your point, I'm not trying to say this to, so don't worry, I'm not saying anything crazy, but I don't want anyone who's pro or anti-Trump to take this statement the wrong way, so don't get upset. But there are a lot of people, like, you can tell by the tweets who really hates Trump and his policies, and then they tie that to their investment thesis, which is the problem that I have, right? Because you're like, there's, like, on Twitter, you'll see this a lot, where it's like, there are people who, and I'm not, like them or don't like them, I'm not giving my political opinion, or so don't want to turn anyone off here, but hating him is not an investment thesis, right?
Or liking him, by the way. Neither is an investment.
Or liking him, to your point. So I think that because I see a lot of these comments that, like, you know, literally today someone told me that they're getting, like, February 2020 vibes. And I'm like, dude, that the market went down 30% because there's a global pandemic. Like, this is not that. Yeah. And to this point, there are these drops on the tariff tweets, which, you know, are annoying for me a lot of times, because, like, hey, you know, I'm long and strong is going well right now. And then, like, 2 seconds, you're like, chunk, and, you know, down we go. But then, you know, of course, rebound. But anyways, the point is that when you look at vols right now, out 1, 2, 3 months, they're very low. So we run this stat called IV rank, which just is like, what is the at the money implied rank of the S&P vol over the last year, right? And we're looking at 1 month options. It's at 10% right now, which tells you that implied vol is in the 10th percentile lows of the last year. Mm-hmm. Which I think if you were looking at Twitter and you're trying to just take people's temperature on things, you wouldn't feel like we were at that kind of spot, right? And and arguably, if you looked at earnings and you're more qualified to probably talk about this than me, you know, Google didn't look very good. Amazon didn't look very good. Microsoft didn't look very good. NVIDIA's earnings are coming up, so that's going to be a big tip. Like, Tesla's down. You're like, so all these stocks are getting pretty beat up, right, on these earnings prints. But here's S&P. We're only not even 1% from all-time highs, and there's no bid to vol. So I always take that into account, because it's like, look, there's 13,000 hedge funds in the world, like all these brain science, you know, rocket scientists out there. No one is interested in really buying puts really at this point. So, you know, is there anything to be scared of as opposed to fear itself? Right.
Well, that to me is, I think that's a signal, right? I mean, I think you know, I make fun of the hyper politicized, environment that is Twitter or X, whatever people want to call it these days. You know, I just use it as a educational tool. You know, I just, okay, look, let me make fun of this hyper-politicized Republican-leaning comment. Let me make fun of this hyper-politicized Democrat-leaning comment, because I want the underlying theme of my message to be, this stuff is nonsense as it relates to generating, you know, alpha or even beta in financial markets, right? Like, it's a detriment most of the time. And so on your point to, with respect to implied volatilities, you know, this is me playing devil's advocate to some degree. A lot of times folks will say, because implied volatility is very low, that's when you want to start buying insurance and being wary about what's peeking around the corner. What are your sort of thoughts on that?
I don't think that's wrong. And, you know, a great trader friend of mine once said, sometimes you just buy vol because it's cheap, right? No other reason. And, you know, there is some truth to that. The cost to hedge your portfolio, particularly via put spreads, you could make the argument that that's a great idea. There was a recent note out by Nomura that was kind of echoing that as well, that, you know, the vol is pretty cheap. There's a little bit of skew. So there's a small amount of skew in the market, put skew, but the overall vols are so low that if you're buying put spreads right now, you're getting them for, again, back to that IV rank metric, for about as cheap as they've been for the last year. On that same token, what I've sort of been pitching to my subscribers and clients is that you can buy 1 month 25 delta calls right now in the S&P, so it's around 6,200 roughly into March for 10% implied vol, which is very cheap in my view. And that, then you don't have to worry about that downside risk, right? If, because it's, you know, you're buying the option, that's your max risk here. So I think that in this case, and if you look at some names like Meta and some of these other big single stocks here, those vols are also very cheap. And so in this instance, it's like, I don't know, you know, I feel like to me, the right tail right now is the setup, because the number one reason is we've been throwing everything at this market that we can, crappy earnings, tariff headlines. S&P doesn't care, right? It's the honey badger market right now. And so I just feel like if there's a small amount of good news, I don't know, Russia, Ukraine, you know, stop, whatever it is, I don't know, no tariff, something, right? Then suddenly maybe NVIDIA earnings will be great. They're coming up here in 2 weeks, right? Then suddenly, you know, we're just kind of ripping and everyone's kind of scratching their head. Like that to me feels like almost the pain trade right now.
Yeah, I agree, by the way, on the macro side of things, just interjecting, you know, we have been bullish. We remain bullish. You know, our KISS signals are, you know, fully invested. Our Dr. Mo signals have max long, you know, proper trade recommendations for most risk asset classes. When you think about, you know, this honey badger market and shrugging off tariff news and shrugging off today, even today, this big, you know, upside surprise in inflation, to me, that tells you the things that we've been talking about, you know, behind our paywall with our clients, you know, the things like, you know, liquidity, both on the U.S. side and global side, likely to accelerate over the next few months, inflation likely to start to go back down over the next few months before ultimately it starts going back up. But you're talking about a spring, you know, kind of late winter to, you know, late spring time period of there could be a lot of good news on the liquidity, inflation front and monetary policy front. We pushed all the rate cuts to, you know, basically the Q4. I mean, what if we pull them back to June or May in terms of market pricing and how that could influence bond yields and equity valuations, right? To me, the market is shrugging off bad news on the tariff front for a reason. And one of those reasons is the fact that we hit the debt ceiling, right? The Treasury was trying to borrow $816 billion of net new marketable borrowing here in Q1. They can't do that. So that's $816 billion that now needs to either stay where it was or go find a home somewhere. Right. And so my opinion, I think that's one of those super supportive dynamics as well. Again, it's not all great news. There are things that are on the negative side that could cause some problems. We could get a really nasty headline from Trump. What if reciprocal tariffs are even worse than what we think they are?
Yes.
It could be very negative. But the reality is, in my opinion, I think I learned this from either you or Jim Carson, which is you never short a dull market. Right? Not saying the market is dull by historical standards in terms of the day-to-day realized volatility we've been talking about, but it's dull from a medium-term standpoint. The trends are still intact. And, yes. And so, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was totally agreeing with you, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that would be, I agree with your take that, you know, the upside risk in this market over a short to medium-term time horizon is more asymmetric to the upside than it is to the downside, in my opinion. I think when you look out, let's call it 2 to 4 quarters, that's when you start to think that, in our opinion, that's when we start to believe that asymmetry is to the downside. But again, our goal as institutional investors is to maximize upside capture in bull markets and minimize downside capture in bear markets. Our goal is not to pontificate on, okay, if I think the market's going to crash in the third quarter, let me start positioning for that now. No, that's not what you would not be an institutional investor for long enough if that's what you're doing.
Yeah. And to your point, most of your clients are probably long stock, I would imagine, for the most part. And puts right now, they're, you know, if you buy options when they're cheap, you're not going to be right every time, but at least you're not overpaying, right? You don't want to buy puts when, you know, that VIX is at 40, right? That's not the right way to do it. And if you actually look at put positioning in the SPX and VIX calls, right, the normal way that people would hedge a portfolio, those positions are actually at 1 year lows, open interest. So, you know, that also speaks to not a ton of hedging. But, you know, if you say, hey, I think we could break out, I'm going to buy a, you know, 3 month put spread here, that's a very reasonable price. It's a low drag on your portfolio, you know, particularly if we do start to kind of move to the upside or do make a decent move to the upside here. So, hedging right now, I think makes a ton of sense, but I don't think it should be one of these things where you're actively looking to short the market. Cause it's just not, people are not following through whatsoever. It's kind of interesting. Yesterday, we were talking about Tesla. Tesla's down 30% in February. So that's in 12 days, it's down 30%. But realized vol, implied vol is actually declining as the stock drops. And so yesterday we saw the largest put flow we've seen in Tesla in 30 days. It was this huge kind of like washout move, right? But the vol didn't really ever spike. So that could speak to some, you know, kind of an unwinding of long stock positions, for example. But it's just another one of these moments where you go, this stock is having kind of a liquidity event here, right? Like it's down 30% 2 weeks, but Tesla Vol is not doing anything. So, you know, again, if you
had all the Democrats selling. That's what it seems like, right? Let's be honest. That's what it seems like.
I mean, you know, you could be right. I don't know. but you know, that vol is not there, right? That belief that there's longer term downside is there is just not, it just doesn't pop up. And that's kind of like this systematic thing. And I think you have to have something that presents as a vol shock or potential vol shock to actually start to unwind flows. And you have to operate in the buy the dip mentality until you see that. And unless there's like a credit crisis, I don't know that there'd be a geopolitical issue. So then the only other thing would be, okay, I guess Chinese tariffs, and I'm starting to get way outside of my purview when I start talking about this. This is your, you know, these are all your lanes. But you need something that starts to lead people to want to buy longer dated vol because they have to hedge that kind of known unknown. Right. And, and we're just not seeing that, right. Just that just doesn't exist.
Well, I do want to transition to some of your you know, products, because you have a phenomenal product suite that, you know, I think it's always important to kind of remind our clients, hey, look, if you are trading in this duration, definitely check out, you know, what Brent is doing over at Spot Gamma. But before we do that, there's one thing I do want to interject and put this on tape, because I thought of it while you were saying tariffs. One of the things that I think Wall Street is very maybe appropriately, maybe inappropriately, we'll see. You know, I don't think we know the answer yet, but it's very appropriate. They're very keen on this sort of using tariffs as a negotiating tool. Mm-hmm. And I think when you think about using tariffs as a negotiating tool, we think about this from the perspective of, I think it's easy to think about it from the perspective of trade, reorganizing trade deals and lowering trade barriers to our various trading partners. One thing that I think is an underpriced upside risk to the market that the market may be sniffing out is the fact that we could potentially be using tariffs as a negotiating tool for a complete revaluation of the dollar. Just like what we saw at the Plaza Accord or the Paris Accord. And, you know, it could be the case that, hey, we're going to say and do something very punitive until you come to the table and allow us to have a 10, 15, 20% revaluation lower in the US dollar. I mean, that would be an explosive move higher in global liquidity. Obviously, an explosive move higher in risk asset pricing terms. I don't know if the bond market would love that, but yeah, I think it will eventually find problem with that after the fact. Mm-hmm. So I want investors to think about this, that there are, you know, right tail risk catalysts too, on top of the left tail risk catalyst that we think will be developing later this year. So maybe that's something the market is potentially sniffing out as it relates to its refusal to bid up, you know, implied vols on a month, 1 month out, 3 month out kind of basis.
Is that, maybe this is a bit of an inner question, but does that relate to the move in gold at all?
Could be. Gold could be sniffing that out. 100%.
What's interesting to me about gold is that it's making all-time highs. But normally what we would see in gold when it makes these moves, or any asset when it makes a significant move, is you would see call prices blow out, right? So we call that call skew, and it would get extremely elevated. And that's basically saying that that it's, stocks are overbought or the asset is overbought. And that's not happening at all right now, which is interesting. It happened over the summer. It happened recently in Chinese stocks. Like, you could see this kind of, you could set your watch to it, where, you know, the fundamentally means if you buy a call right now, the odds of that call paying off is very limited, right? There's, you could make an argument of hedging flows starting to act against the stock and blah, blah, blah. But the point is, just from a barometer of demand, it actually seems like call prices haven't responded at all, which I think is really interesting, because usually these things end in a, like a convex move, and it seems kind of like it's boiling and maybe it's sniffing something out. But
tells you the move isn't over.
Yeah.
So what do you got to, you know, what's top of mind in terms of some of the new tools you guys are delivering to investors?
I think the big thing that I feel like macro investors may miss out is the information that's embedded in options prices, and that's true even if you are, you know, holding over a longer term time horizon. So I can give you an example of what we're looking at in option skews, if you'd like, and just kind of, you know, relay this. So, yeah, if you don't mind sharing, that'd be great.
So what are we looking at here, my friend?
So what we have here is just S&P skew. So this is 1 month skew in green, and then we have 3 month skew here in gray. Mm-hmm. And so you can see the expiration date. And so these cones are the 90-day statistical range of these implied vols, right? Mm-hmm. So if we just start by looking at this green line, I mentioned before recommending 1 month 25 delta calls as an area, as an interesting area. And so you could see that is roughly where this green line meets this cone. And that cone, again, is the statistical range over the last 90 days for one-month options prices. So the lower this skew goes, the cheaper or the closer to the bottom or top of this green line is or areas, the cheaper or more expensive the option is relative to recent statistics. And so when you start looking at this upside, and if I hover over that, you could see, you know, these calls I was recommending before, the 25 delta calls. That's a 10% implied vol. The 10th percentile low for that is 9. You don't get S&P vols for under 9, really. They just, you know, you got to go back like 2017, maybe, right? Yeah. So, you know, if you start saying I'm buying a 25 delta call at 6,200, you and I could both make the case that in a month we could be at 6,200, right? Any investor could. That's not like we're buying a 10% out of the money S&P option. So that to me is really rather cheap. And when you start to look at a similar option, we usually look at 25 delta calls in this space because it's like, it's out of the money, but it's achievable, right? It's not this crazy tail option. So, you know, you can see the same thing here in gray, which is the 3 month option, where you go, okay, you know, these vol, it's an 11% implied vol. And, you know, we get down into the 10% implied vol is the 1 year kind of low, really, right? Or 90 day low, I should say. So this upside is really very cheap. It's a very cheap way to express that upside. And then to the downside, you know, you can also look at how expensive options are to like hedge that downside risk as well, right? And I would say overall implied vol is low. There's a little bit of skew, which means that this line curves up a little bit more than it normally does. Mm-hmm. So you can put a put spread on there to help offset that cost a little bit. And that's a very cheap structure right now to hedge this downside if you're worried about, you know, a tariff headline kind of ruining your day, right? But that starts to get really interesting to me. And then I think the other interesting thing for macro people is, you know, how do you take advantage of situations where maybe you want to overwrite calls? And I think systematic call overwriting as a strategy is a bad idea because you are – generally, from a total return basis, if you look at the big funds that do this, it's terrible from a total return basis. Stocks only go up, which is why it's so bad from a total return basis right now.
I tell people this all the time. Market goes up over time. Don't short it.
but, you know, the other thing that's funny about that is that people don't care, right? That the assets in these products continue to grow. There's a zero DTE put selling ETF, for example, that just keeps gathering assets, and it has a terrible negative skew to the payoff profile and all that. But people go, oh, it offers a 100% dividend or whatever, so I'm doing it. Anyways, that being said, you know, when you want to think about possibly overriding some positions that you have, I brought up Alibaba here before because options prices are extremely stretched right now to the upside. Obviously, these stocks have been catching a tremendous, you know, Chinese bounce. And so, you know, you start to look here at a 25 delta call or 20 delta call, either 3 months out or 1 month out, and you can see how stretched that implied volatility is, right? We're above these trading ranges, that we've seen for the last 90 days. You can look at some other things in our platform that show you statistically the IV rank and skew rank and things like that. So these present these moments where I feel like sometimes as an investor, it's hard to say, hey, I don't want to sell Alibaba, but the momentum, it's gone convex. Like, what am I supposed to do here? How do I monetize some of this? I don't want to sell this position. Call overriding can make some sense in these situations, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly, we mentioned the you know, 16% down day in NVIDIA. We see equivalent moves in names like this now to the upside as well, right? Like Tesla after the election period. It was up 50% in a matter of like 3 days or whatever it was. So you get those situations where the options prices go convex as well. They hit these levels like what we're looking at now where they're so rich that for BABA to maintain the price momentum needed to make these calls pay off starts to become like statistically like just super improbable, right? Like there's no definites in this game, obviously, as you well know. But you start to go, okay, this makes sense tactically to take some off the table or cap a little bit upside or sell a little bit of upside risk to, you know, monetize that with some call selling. And then when that vol comes back in, you close up your calls and you still have your asset, right? So those are some of the things. And like I mentioned gold before. So this tells me that also when the vols are like this crazy, it's like, okay, I can state that this is sort of overbought from a short-term momentum perspective because it's being reflected in these options prices, right? It's options market makers that set these prices. They're smart, right? Very. We all know, you know, Ken Griffin and the like, you know, they didn't become billionaires.
The smartest people in the world, let alone on Wall Street.
Right. So, you know, they're the ones that set these prices. But again, if we just look at gold and we say, okay, is gold at that spot, even though it's had a tremendous run, you know, you could see like, okay, these are, you know, these vols are elevated here, but they're not, you know, it's not that same, you know, first of all, there's not a call skew here, meaning that the shape of this slope is not really like the ramp, like Baba was, right?
Totally.
Puts are still higher priced than calls in this case, and it's starting to maybe catch that momentum breakout where, you know, you'd see, and I don't know, I could probably draw on this, right? Where you, if you saw a gold skew do that, then you go, okay, this is now crazy and overbought. But we're not there. So this is interesting to me because it suggests that it's getting warmed up, right? And kind of getting to that spot where it's just starting to get levered. And then here is like, okay, we're levered. And now I want to take some off the table.
Would you expect a 3 month, which is the gray portion of the chart, to break out to call skew before the 1 month, the green?
No, 1 month for sure. I mean, the reason is because the short dated options react faster. So this is term structure in gold, and those shorter dated implied vols are always going to be more sensitive, right? So they should shift to more convex nature more quickly, particularly now in the days of call demand, right? You know, there, it's one thing for the call skew to shift because there's a bunch of moves. So there's like a new realized vol that has to get kind of priced in, or that price momentum has to get priced in, and skew would shift off of that. But the second one is demand, right? If people start buying tons of calls, that's going to shift that skew up, because as that demand comes in, prices have to rise, and market makers can protect themselves against upside risk by charging more for the calls, right? So it's like, as a market maker, I have to be there on the market to sell you calls, Darius, but I'm just going to sell you at a price that you may not like, or I think you're kind of foolish for overpaying, right?
GameStop.
Yeah, exactly, right? And that doesn't deter people a lot of times. You know, it's akin to saying, I don't want to move, right? I don't want to sell my house right now, but if you offer me $10 million for my house, like it's done.
Sold to you.
No problem. And if you're willing to make that payment, Darius, I'll take it. Nice house.
We'll talk offline. No, this is fascinating stuff, man. I really can't stress enough the amount of information that you not only you summarize, but you reconvey very well, right? Like if you just sort of looked at the options structure, yeah, as an individual person, as an investor, it is overwhelming, right? There's all kinds of dimensions of price, of volatility, of time, of strike. There's, you know, it's an overwhelming market from an information standpoint. So one of the things I think you are, again, one of the world's best at, if not the world's best at, is making sense of this information for investors. So highly recommend anybody watching this, definitely go check you guys out.
Thank you so much, Darius. And I think the trick here is that to me, when I'm talking about this stuff, is that, you know, for the macro folks, is on a daily basis, the market's not, you know, it's fairly quiet. There's always something interesting in single stock space, but there are those times, you know, it's once a quarter or so where, you know, I think your eyes should be on the options market and in the information that's being, you know, relayed. So like August 5th, for example, right? You may not care about options flows on a daily basis, but those are the events, particularly where VIX is spiking, right? You get VIX in the 20, and then you want to know what the options market's telling you because, again, there's so much information embedded in that. And just as an example of that, you know, we had the CPI today, right? This is what this big drop is.
Yeah.
The green line is monitoring the hedging flows from zero DT options. Okay, so it only looks at zero DT options, so options expire today, and how much notional value do market makers have to hedge? So if this line is going up, it suggests that dealers and market makers have to buy stock, and if the line is going down, it suggests they have to sell stock. Mm-hmm. We're comparing that to all expiration flow. So the CPI today was hot. People had all sorts of hot takes about that on Twitter and everywhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
The difference between all expiration order flow, which is purple, and zero DT order flow today is this is negligible. So what this tells me is if you told me, we're telling me today that the CPI today changed the game, and obviously the market bounced so much that people are not expecting this, but when you look at this flow in the morning, there was no put buying longer dated put buying to come in to suggest that people want to express downside views, right? Because if they did, then you would see this purple line right here continue to go down. And the reason that line will go down is because people are starting to buy March puts, they're buying Feb puts, they're buying December puts, right? Because they go, this CPI definitely was a game changer, we're in trouble. But what you see here is that no one followed through really, right? In fact, as soon as the market opens right here, people sell their puts and buy their calls and the market bounce. And a lot of that's just zero DTE order flow. So when I am trying to say, hey, did whatever just happen, did it actually mean something, right? If you look at the order flow, as you know, you could go, oh, well, if people really cared, they'd be buying puts, right? If people didn't like this earnings drop in Amazon, they wouldn't be buying calls the day after, right, the stock dropped. And so, you know, not only that, it's all zero DTE order flow today, which tells me that the CPI just didn't, no one cares, right? And if nobody cares, the default position for the market's going to be a rebound, right? Because you always have a little bit of event volatility to these CPI things. And as soon as the event passes, the vol comes off, and that's called VANA, we call it, and it lifts the market up. And so, you know, those types of things are always interesting. And so, again, day in and day out, a lot of you macro folks, I understand. It's like, I don't care what the condor, zero DT condor is at today, right? But you get those moments in time, two, three times a quarter, that you'll want to know what that information, I think, is telling you.
I think two or three times a month. I mean, we got a jobs report, CPI, PC report. I mean, there are times where, you know, you mentioned over the last, you know, couple of years was really relevant. I don't think it's relevant anymore. I think it's exposed. But look, I think this, what does HERO stand for?
Hedging impact of real-time options. That's what that's called. And so, you know, literally just measuring the delta, the hedging impact of everyone buying puts and calls. And so, you know, I don't want to overwhelm people here with different lines of stuff on the chart, but you could just see here, right? Like blue is put flow. Mm-hmm. Where you can see after, you know, it trended down a little bit, but you have $3.5 billion of call flow coming into the market today. And so, you know, people were really buying that dip, right? And the other thing that's interesting about this too is the options pricing, right? The options pricing today in terms of zero DT, they were pricing in 60 bips of market movement, which is just not very much, you know. So people are saying this is the most important CPI reading of our generation or whatever. You hear these, you know,
biblical
statements. Yeah. And then you look at the options pricing, you go like 60 bips is the average daily move in the S&P, I think, is 60 bips, right? So we're pricing in an average day. You know, it's like, who cares? There's like a famous scene in Jurassic Park. You're old enough to remember Jurassic Park, but it's Newman from Jurassic Park sitting at the table with the CIA agent. He's like, you know, we got so-and-so here. We got to see, nobody cares. And that's kind of like how I feel about a lot of these events. It's like the macro Twitter people are on there. And it's like, nobody cares. It's hot. Nobody cares. Because the options market would say this is a 1%, 2% event. At the end of 2022, CPIs were pricing in 1.5% of daily movement. That was a lot, right? That mattered. This didn't really matter. It's easy to say that here when the market has bounced like it did, but you know, it's curious that the options market only said, hey, 60 bips of movement we're pricing for today. So
that's super. I mean, what you just said is valuable information. Right. Like there are some investors that are going to be staring at the price chart, the price of S&P intraday price response and say, this is red. The people who voted 5.3% 1 year ahead CPI in that University of Mish report from Friday, which obviously was the Democrats, they're going to say this is rigged.
That was a crazy chart.
Totally. I mean, I'm not even kidding you, Brent. I laughed out loud when I saw it, like nerdy as that sounds, but like, I was like, this is hilarious. But anyway, but you know, 2 years from now or 4 years from now, whatever, it'll be the exact same thing in reverse, right? Mm-hmm. And so the key takeaway is you want to be using, you know, tools like this to figure out what is actually true. And I would layer on secondarily, you want to be responding to signal, right? Like, most of what we interpret as investors from either, you know, government agencies when they give us incremental data, private sector, you know, organizations that give us data, a lot of the information in the market, it's not signal. It's noise along the way towards generating or unwinding a signal. But the response that you need to make in your portfolio should be as a function of a signal changing, right? And what I think you just described with your HERO tool here is that the signal hasn't changed. We're still in a buy the dip uptrend market, despite the fact that CPI came in hot, because what it ultimately is suggesting is a variety of things, one of which of those things could be CPI will be better behaved in the coming months, you know, after this sort of January seasonality blip. So fascinating stuff, man. I know you're about to travel this today, so I'll let you run. But before we do that, I love to, I love the Indies conversations. Like, what's the, with the risk management point, that was kind of mine. What's one risk management sort of, lesson you've learned or internalized throughout your career in the last few years that you think is, you can't live without?
I think that so much of what drives the market now is just, price for me, right? And this market has really reinforced the idea that the money is almost made when you buy, when you buy the asset or buy the stock, right? And that, to me, this market seems to be more true. That seems to be more true, right? There's so much chasing now. Things are very frenetic, particularly in the short term. And, when you look at like NVIDIA being down 16%, obviously in hindsight, had you bought that, well, you made your money there, right? Because it was down so much on this stretch move. And so I think with all these headlines whipping around and, how fast things are moving, there's truth in price. And, there are those times where I think you probably had it too. Like, you just bought something, you go, I just paid the wrong price for that thing, right? And I think that this market's really, that's being reinforced, right? To the point of buying options because I think they're cheap, or, selling them because I think they're expensive. If you pay too much attention to the noise, you can get shaken out of that, I think, pretty easily. And oftentimes that's wrong. So, I'm really just kind of focused on that, right? It's almost like get off of the Twitter, get off of the noise, and pay attention to price. And, if you buy things at what you think are reasonable prices, then you're going to do well. And if you pay too much off of an emotional kind of overshoot, then you're going to get tagged. So
I love it.
Yeah, it's basic, but that seems to be really, what it is.
I'll add a secondary point to that, Brent, which is, our entire risk management process, 100% of the asset allocation and portfolio construction recommendations that we make for our clients are a function of our price and volatility tools, right? We don't make, fundamentally oriented risk management decisions like, oh, buy the treasury bond because inflation is slowing, or buy stocks because growth's accelerating. We don't make those calls anymore, over the last 2+ years now. And our track record over the last 2+ years has, been up there with anybody, in my opinion, because
absolutely, I've seen that.
Markets have trended more towards being price and volatility machines and momentum machines. And the thing I will say, I'll leave investors with, and I actually love your take on this before we go. I think in a world where we have more AI informing investors and ultimately making investment decisions, our ability as investors to connect the dot between tomorrow's price and some fundamental catalyst that we believe in, or some narrative that we construct in our head, our ability to do that will go down. Because the AIs will make, they will just be better at that than us, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the whole point of AI. And so if you don't have systems that are taking advantage of momentum and inflections in momentum and asset markets in terms of price and volatility terms that are weaved into your risk management process, I think you're going to struggle as an investor as we move forward in time, with the advent of AI. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I think that's totally true. As an analyst, fortunately I own my business. So, but if I was just a regular old analyst sitting at a desk, I would be watching this stuff and I'd be a little bit nervous, right? Mm-hmm. Because, the notes we write every day and you're like, well, AI could put a lot of that together. But, the AI is going to be telling everyone kind of the same thing, right? And it's these rules and lessons that are, kind of everybody knows, right? And if everybody knows it, what's the value of the information, I guess? And so, the experience of different cycles matters, the ability to sort of weigh different pieces of information and have, some of these kind of proprietary indicators that are time tested, I think, can be really quite valuable, kind of to your point. So I think a lot about that. And I think just from my perspective, you do an incredible job of navigating this stuff. I try to understand. I mean, usually I'm in learning mode. I'm listening to you as opposed to trying to converse with you about things.
I appreciate you. Likewise.
Feels the same way. Yeah, but you know, there, you know, the idea that all information is known by all market participants, unless of course there's inside information, right? That's a well-known axiom in markets, and it's, to me, it's price dislocation and understanding why there's price dislocation, and that I think there's edge, and that obviously comes from watching the options market. But I think probably it's the same thing, you know, with what you're looking at, just on different time frames, right? And and ultimately, unless someone is being forced out of something, or there's a flow perspective. Like for me, it's like, hey, I think people are hedging this, and that's why the price is, or there's a margin call, right? And that's why the price is getting, you know, pushed out of the way. But, you know, if everyone is reading off of AI and they're wrong, then maybe that creates a lot of other price dislocations where Darius is like, hey, I know that everyone who used ChatGPT to model their portfolio is thinking this thing, and they're all thinking the wrong thing.
Which is going to create more violent cycles, right? Like they'll be right for a more violent, longer period of time, but when they become wrong, it's going to be very wrong, you know, for a more violent, longer perhaps period of time. I think that, but again, that I still think that puts the onus on having systems and signals like these to spot those critical inflections, as opposed to trying to predict those critical inflections, because I don't think at all that we as humans are going to be able to do that very well. I think we've already proven it. Just look at people's track records over the past half decade, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, buying, you know, it's like, it's a funny thing. There's a lot of groups that are like, you just buy the S&P because of inflation and passive index, and like it goes up over time. And like, it's easy to say right now, right? In 2022, it didn't feel that good, right? Mm-hmm. On August 5th of 2024, that didn't kind of like feel good as like a process either. So
2009 certainly didn't feel
very good. There's like, sometimes it doesn't work. So that, you know, the timeframes are important. But again, to your point on the AI and GPT, it's like, it's just commoditizing a lot of the information that's out there. It's allowing people to put all that information together, which can be powerful, but if everybody knows it, then everybody knows it, you know, what is the edge? Yeah. And so, you know,
the edge is in predicting the inflections.
Yeah. And you have to have a different viewpoint than everybody else. Otherwise you're just going to be in the same bucket there. So maybe you'll make your 8% a year and hey, that's great. But if you're trying to either not be down in the down year or beat the market, you have to have a different viewpoint, right? Otherwise everything is priced to perfection at all times, technically. Right. Yeah. So, you know, unless you have a different viewpoint on something, then I guess you should never have a trade.
Yeah, perhaps. Well, Brent, man, this is another masterclass, man. I learn a tremendous amount every time we connect. I think you guys are doing a grave disservice to yourselves and your portfolio if you don't go check out Spot Gamma after listening to this, because you're not going to find better information out there. So we'll wrap it up, man. Appreciate you, man. Safe travels. Thanks again for all your time, brother.
Thank you, Darius. I love seeing you again, and hopefully we can get together once it warms up a little. I know we're not too far away from each other, but appreciate the opportunity very much, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Likewise, brother. Be good, man.
Disclaimer, 42 Macro does not provide, and no portion of our content purports to be, individualized or specific investment advice, and 42 Macro does not provide investment advice to individuals. All information provided by 42 Macro is general in nature and is made without regard to individual levels of sophistication or investment experience, investment preferences, objectives, or risk parameters, and without regard to the suitability of the content for individuals or entities who may access it. No information provided by 42 Macro should be construed as an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor should it be construed as tailored or specific to you or consumer thereof. You understand and agree that our content does not constitute specific recommendations of any particular investment, security, portfolio, transaction, or strategy, nor does it recommend any specific course of action is suitable for any specific person or entity or group of persons or entities. At any point in time, the employees of 42 Macro may own a portion of or all the ETF securities discussed in 42 Macro Research content. 42 Macro Research content is based upon information from sources believed to be reliable. 42 Macro is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information, nor is it responsible for the accuracy or authenticity of the information upon which it relies.